The small groups and life groups and so on are discussing that further and things that they're learning. So, and maybe you haven't participated in the reading through the Gospels with us. It's not too late to start. You can just jump right in and join us for the rest of the way. We hope that you will. And I'm trying to preach from those various sections that you're reading the previous week. And so here's what I'd like for you to do. Just take a second and share one thing you discovered this week about Jesus or something that really struck you about that. Just briefly share that with someone sitting near you. And if you've not been doing it, then you ask the person near you, what did you learn? Okay, in your 90 days with Jesus. So go ahead, take a moment. Now, the problem with an assignment like that is how do you do that in a few seconds? That's pretty hard. But that's a good challenge for us because that's what I want you to be doing in your conversations with friends and neighbors and family members. Say, hey, you know what? I was reading in Luke 14 and here's what I discovered, you know, this week. And tell them briefly one thing. And it might enter, oh, you're reading through? What's that about? And say, hey, why don't you join us? So you got a good chance to share some good things that the Lord's teaching and it will be a help. Well, let's get into it this morning. Luke 14, if you want to open your Bibles. Luke 14, 25 begins, large crowds were traveling with Jesus. Now, that's what every preacher wants, isn't it? And I would love to fill this place up five times every Sunday, standing room only, wouldn't you? Wouldn't that be great? That'd be pretty exciting. Jesus said that he came to seek and save the lost, and I'm with him all the way. Let's get as many people as we can to know Jesus. What does a church do to get a crowd and keep a crowd? Now, I love a crowd, but there are some things that I would not do for the sake of a crowd, and there are some things I must preach regardless of the crowd. Jesus draws a crowd. Lots of people wanted to hang out with Jesus, and I don't blame them, but Jesus is calling committed followers, not spectators, not consumers, not fans. Jesus must have never read Dale Carnegie's How to Win Friends and Influence People. Evidently, no one taught him about being politically correct and all that, because Jesus used some extreme language and imagery to get the crowds to understand the seriousness of following him and to honestly assess their commitment. And he said things that didn't attract people necessarily. It drove people away. So let's take a look at Luke 14, starting with verse 25. Large crowds were traveling with Jesus, and turning to them, he said, "If anyone comes to me and does not hate his father and mother, his wife and children, his brothers and sisters, yes, even his own life, he cannot be my disciple. Anyone who does not carry his cross and follow me cannot be my disciple. Suppose one of you wants to build a tower. Will he not first sit down and estimate the cost to see if he has enough money to complete it? For if he lays a foundation and is not able to finish it, everyone who sees it will ridicule him, saying, 'This fellow began to build and was not able to finish.' Or suppose a king is about to go to war against another king. Will he not first sit down and consider whether he is able with 10,000 men to oppose the one coming against him with 20,000? If he is not able, he will send a delegation while the other is still a long way off, and he will ask for terms of peace. In the same way, any of you who does not give up everything, he cannot be my disciple. Salt is good, but if it loses its saltiness,
How can it be made salty again? It's fit neither for the soil nor the manure pile. It's thrown out. He who has ears, let him hear. Let him hear. Now, hyperbole is extreme exaggeration. It's shock and awe statements. And the Jews loved hyperbole. You can see it a lot in their teaching and language and lifestyle. And Jesus used hyperbole, therefore, a lot. And he used it as he taught both humorously and provocatively, as we'll see later today. But for example, he illustrated it's easier for a camel to go through the eye of a needle than for a rich man to enter the kingdom. And he talked about getting a log out of your own eye before trying to get the speck out of the neighbor's eye. Try to picture that cartoon, right? Log coming out of your eye, you know. And that is ludicrously humorous imagery. But his message in Luke 14 is not funny at all. It's not intended to be. So let's explore some of the extremes of this passage, of this teaching. Extreme costs, for example. Now, we like to think about all the grace and blessings of Jesus. We don't want to think about the demands and the costs. But there are some involved. Jesus says, if you want to follow him, you must hate family. Heads jerked to attention. Murmur rippled through that crowd. Whoa, what? Wait, what? You know, did he just say what I think he said? So it was a shocking statement for them to hear. And that's going too far, Jesus. Because I thought we're supposed to love my families. I dearly love my family. But this apparent discrepancy is easily explained. Remember, this is hyperbole. Jesus didn't literally mean we're to hate our families now any more than he expects us to literally die on a cross for him. Jesus was using this exaggerated imagery to stress the extreme relational priority we are to have with him in our lives. In fact, a parallel statement in another gospel says that we are to love him more than we love our family. But here he used this hyperbole. Now, sadly, it is true there are situations that some have committed their lives to Jesus, and as a result, they've been expelled by their family. In fact, they became enemies in the family, not by their will, but by the family's response, reaction, and that's a big cost. Now, if family, hating family is not enough, then he added, even your own life, you got to hate your own life. Wait a minute. My life's pretty dear to me. How about you? I mean, Jesus slams, man, he slams into our first love. Admit it. A lot of what we do is first and foremost for ourselves. It really is. Again, Jesus doesn't literally mean, though, to hate yourself. He doesn't want us to do that. But that's exaggerated language, and it means to love him more than self. The only way to follow Jesus is to push self out of the way, to beat back all our selfish desires and ambitions and self-preservation's concerns and the things we worry. Self-sacrifice, self-denial is the way of his disciples. But then he amps up the expectation with more extreme language. Take up your cross. Take up your cross. What a graphically horrifying and detestable image in that time, especially to the Jews. Carrying your own cross was a bloody, agonizing death sentence. What Jesus was saying was quite disturbing. It was revolting even. Terrifying. And some of those first century believers were literally crucified like Jesus. For Jesus. And traditionally, says the Apostle Peter, was crucified upside down. It sounds extreme, and it is. He's being very extreme here. But the real idea that we need to get from this is that we need to lay down our lives and even give up our lives if necessary. Surrender to Jesus as Lord and Savior and for His purposes at all costs. The Apostle Paul said it this way, I have been crucified with Christ, and I no longer live, but Christ lives in me. That's what Jesus is after. And there's more extremes. He says, you got to give up everything. Everything? You mean everything? Everything you have. This is a comprehensive expectation. And I think it's a little bit difficult to wrap our minds around it even. You know, every possession, every dream, every thought, every word, every ability, every accomplishment, everything. And part of that means you can't rely on your own goodness. Because your good is not good enough. You have to rely on His grace now. Following Jesus is extremely demanding, and this teaching accentuates what Jesus is teaching even in the surrounding context here. Because if you backpedal, if you look earlier in Luke chapter 14, Jesus was at a Pharisee's house, and He's telling this self-righteous man to be careful about, and He's telling the self-righteous people to be careful about what they use to measure value and righteousness, and they need to humble themselves. And they need to receive all people, even the poor and the weak and the outcast, with honor. And next, He tells this parable of the banquet, and it parallels the same kind of theme here. But then everybody is making up excuses as to why they couldn't come to the wedding banquet. Well, sorry, I have to check out the new property I bought. Sorry, I have to test drive my new oxen. Or this is the best excuse. I just got married, so I have to check with my wife. Right? You guys know what I'm talking about? And Jesus says, all this stuff that you think is so important isn't. Just isn't. You have to give it all up and follow me. And then if you look forward in the context, in the parables that come in the next chapter, chapter 15, you've got this rebellious son who can't come home. He can't be rescued from his wayward lifestyle until he realizes that his dad has everything he needs. And so he humbles himself, surrendering his life back to his father. Sorry for what he's done. Plus, in that story, there's a big brother who self-righteously begins to cite all his credentials of worth to his father, saying he deserves the honors that his brother's receiving. He begrudges his brother's return and all the blessings he's getting when the boy comes home. And it's in that context that Jesus is saying, unless you humbly give up all, you can't be my disciple. It's not about your self-worth and your righteousness. It's about humbly counting all that as loss and depending totally on Him. Today, there's a fair number of people who go to church. They volunteer sometimes, and they give sometimes. And they love the inspiration of the community, you know. And they just want to retain control of their lives. They're touched when Jesus does marvelous things. And they're glad to be associated with Jesus. But they don't want to risk anything. Success or changing their lifestyle or taking their responsibility to restore a crumbling marriage or investing time in a life group or giving up sleeping with somebody that they aren't married to and trusting that telling the truth is better than deceiving to protect their reputation. And they don't want anyone to think that they're imposing their faith on them. And you know what? I know there's a lot of people in need, and they really should do something about it. But, you know, it's going to cost a lot of time and effort. And they're not surrendered. And they're not salty. Have you noticed our culture's obsession with authenticity these days? I mean, we despise hypocrisy. And if there's the slightest hint of someone or something being artificial, I'm out of here. And in fact, one of the great charges against the church today is it's contrived. But isn't it ironic that the same culture that demands authenticity won't even make a commitment? or keep one. Everybody really doesn't want to make a commitment. They like to keep their options open. We've grown comfortable with partial commitments, half-hearted commitments, loose associations. We recognize that something's terribly wrong inside us, but we don't want to address the source of our problems. We know our relationships are lacking something critical, but we don't want the selfless sacrifice that leads to healthy relationships. We want our kids to be spiritually vital, but we don't want them missing out on the pleasures of the world at the same time. We want a foot in the faith and a foot in the world, but Jesus doesn't give us that option. Not at all. Not the way I read this teaching. There is a big difference between an admirer and a follower. An admirer is impressed. A follower is devoted. An admirer applauds. A follower surrenders his life or her life. You know, a lot of people admired Martin Luther King Jr. Some marched with him. Not many went to jail with him. Not many got their houses bombed like he did or assassinated. A lot of people admired Mother Teresa, but not many people followed her to live among the destitute and dying. You know, the crowds traveled with Jesus, but really not many followed him. There's some extreme costs. So we better do some extreme calculations. That's what Jesus seems to be indicating here. Like the builder and the king facing war, we must do some serious self-examination. Will you really follow through with Jesus? Can you last? Will you be there all the way to the end? Will you pay the price? Are you serious enough to do whatever it takes to follow Jesus and keep following him? Whatever he asks. Carefully now, assess your commitment. 32 years ago plus, I carefully calculated my commitment to Brenda. And it wasn't anything impulsive or passionate in my decision to marry her. In fact, we dated 4 years before we were married. And I pledged her my lifetime love with a good idea of what that meant and what it would take. My intentions were pure. My devotion was sincere. I thought I knew. But I didn't know. And as we've met those challenges and storms together, I found out. I found out what it means. I found out the cost firsthand, experientially. And she found out the price was higher than she expected to be married to me. But we've remained faithful to that pledge. And that commitment has seen us through. And it's been a beautiful life together. And I can say I love her more than I've ever loved her. In fact, we're just now discovering some of the deepest treasures of lifetime love. And it's well worth the commitment. Well worth it. It happened in a place called Bullhead City, Arizona. There's a big confrontation between city officials and local veterans. The city held a huge ceremony honoring the vets and dedicated a new Veterans Memorial Park, lighting a torch as the centerpiece, and they called it the Eternal Flame. And all went well until the city, until they got the first gas bill for the Eternal Flame. It was $961, and they immediately shut off the Eternal Flame. But then they ended up turning it back on because the vets got all upset and they were complaining. So now they had to discuss what they were going to do. Do they put in a smaller burner for the Eternal Flame, or maybe only light it during the Eternal Flame during special occasions? You know, somebody forgot to count the cost, and it happens all the time, and you've done it. In North Korea, there was a famous hotel, the Phantom Pyramid. Hotel of Doom, as it's referred to. 105 stories high. It dominates the skyline. It has 3,000 rooms, total of 3.9 million square feet. It is the 22nd highest building in the world. Construction began back in 1987 and continued until 1992. North Korea poured nearly 2% of their gross domestic product into this project. But you know, today when pictures are taken, government officials sometimes airbrush the hotel out of the picture. Why? Embarrassment. Because they ran out of money. And they had engineering problems. And they hadn't finished the project. It's an architectural nightmare. From 1992 to 2008, that monstrosity stood unfinished. Just looming over the city. Just stands out so much. In 2008, though, construction resumed, finally promising to open in 2012. And they did a lot of work on the exterior, and they didn't get it open in 2012. So they promised 2013, and then they promised 2017. And you know what? That hotel remains unfit for occupation to this day. Somebody forgot to count the cost. Man, they fit Jesus' parable vividly, and it's irrelevant to our world, to our lives. I wonder how many skeleton buildings stand in your life. There are dozens of ways we already articulate and live out this concept. You fill in the blank for me. She bit off more than she could. Yeah, okay. His eyes were bigger than his. You picked a fight with the wrong guy, wrong person. Somebody forgot to do their homework. Yeah, he didn't look before he... Eyes didn't stop and... Yeah, you brought a knife to a... Yeah, okay. The criteria that Jesus lays out here to be his disciples is not intended to be a standard that makes us give up because, hey, I can never live up to it. I can't do this. No, this is exaggerated language. This is to challenge us, to prompt us to aspire to be the most devoted disciple that we can be. It's having a good idea of what it's going to cost. And we're willing to lay down everything because it's worth the cost. You know, I haven't perfectly lived up to all my vows to Brenda and all that I intended to love her. But I see it's worth the cost and I'm doing everything that I can. It's relentlessly trusting in His grace because we are not qualified and we do fail. But we're compelled by that grace to stick with Jesus no matter what. To grow stronger and stronger in our commitment. As John Ortberg describes, something deep inside says, this is it. This is it. This is what I've been longing for my whole life. To know God. To be forgiven. To have a life beyond worry, beyond fear, beyond these things that enslave me. My desires and unhealthy habits, the need for more and more stuff and money. To be a part of God's cause to redeem the world. To not be afraid of death anymore. See, I would rather have what this man has and give up everything else in the world than to have everything else the world can offer me and give up this man. Therefore, I will pay any price. I will do whatever he wants me to do. Today, I'm leaving the crowd. I will live as a fully devoted follower of this man, Jesus.
Juan Carlos Ortiz uses, invites us to imagine this dialogue with Jesus, where Jesus says, you need to do some intense personal calculations if you want to be my disciples. It's going to cost everything that you have. You say, okay, I'm in. I'll do it. He says, well, what do you have? Well, let's see. I have $10,000 in the bank. Good. What else? Well, what do you mean? That's all I have in the bank. I don't have anything. Nothing else? Well, let's see. I guess I do have a few dollars in my pocket. And he said, well, how much you have? How many dollars? Well, I've got $120. Great. What else? Well, that's it. You've cleaned me out, Jesus. Well, where do you live? Well, I live in my house, of course. I'll take it. The house? Yeah, the house. Where am I supposed to live? In the garage? Oh, you didn't tell me you had a garage. That'll become mine as well. Hey, you want my family and me to live in my car? That's a bit extreme, Jesus. You have a car? Well, I happen to have two. Both are now mine.
Jesus, you can't put us out on the street. You've taken everything. House, garage, car, money. I have no assets, no transportation, no place to live. Next, you'll be wanting my job. Well, what is it you do? Where do you work? Well, I work at Children's Hospital. Oh, I can use that. Your job and career belong to me now. How am I going to make a living? How am I going to take care of my family? Tell me about your family. Well, I have a wife and two children. Your family become mine too. What? My family? I'll be all alone in this world. Well, don't you have any friends? Well, sure I have friends. Well, all your relationships, all of them are mine. Jesus, you've stripped me down to nothing. You've taken everything. I'm all alone now. Oh, I want you. You know, that's what I want most. You. And there's a long, quiet pause of realization. And then Jesus says, now everything that you've turned over to me, you can use. Use it freely. But don't forget, all these are mine. You're mine. And whenever I need any of these things, you got to give them to me, use them for me, because I'm the owner. Takes some careful calculation, doesn't it? One of the inspirational moments in modern Olympic history was John Akwari of Tanzania. And he began to suffer painful leg cramps as he ran, as he was competing in the marathon. And then, making matters worse, a bunch of runners jostling along, and he got bumped. And he took a bad fall, causing a deep gash in his knee, suffered dislocation. He smashed his shoulder against the pavement, and he should have gone to the hospital at that point, but he just received a little medical treatment, and he continued the race. And long after all the other competitors crossed the finish line, most of the crowd had left the stadium, but into the stadium limped John Akwari, all alone, bandaged and bleeding. And the stragglers of this crowd who had stayed around to the last moment stood applauding him. And when asked why he didn't give up, Akwari simply explained, my country did not send me 7,000 miles to start this race. My country sent me to finish. Listen, it is with a spirit of dedication and enduring faith and a passionate love for Jesus that we run all the way through the finish line, wherever he's taking us and whatever he asks of us, even if we cross that line limping. So you know what? He's making sure we understand there's some extreme consequences here. If you look at verses 34 and 35, not even fit for the manure pile. That's disgusting. What's that all about? Why this extreme imagery here? I mean, why do we have to have this filthy talk? Why are we talking about this even? I don't want to talk about that. Well, he's talking about an enduring saltiness. It's about walking with Jesus, steadfastly abiding in him so that we remain salty. His fruit in us impacting everyone that we come in contact with. Salt was sometimes added to manure to enhance the fertilization impact of the manure. It's for fertilizer, as you know, all right? So over time, moisture can dissolve and reduce the sodium chloride that makes salt salty. So Jesus is graphically saying, we're not even worth the manure pile if we lose our saltiness. Can't do any good. If we don't last, if we lose our distinctiveness, Christ in us, if we're not having impact in this world, then we're thrown out as useless, worthless to the kingdom. We're not who we say we are or who we think we are. This extreme graphic imagery is a strong warning to us. We all get to choose our relationship with Jesus. We get to choose. But we should do so realizing the consequences of following him or not following him, not sticking with it. Jesus said, be faithful until death, and I'll give you the crown of life. But he also warned, I know your deeds, that you're neither cold nor hot. Because you are lukewarm, I'm about to spew you out of my mouth. We need to calculate, but in so doing, we better weigh the consequences of each option of where we want to be here. But the great thing, I think, about this whole thing is the extreme Christ. Another way to think about these parables, I think, of the builder and the king going off to war, is to realize that Jesus himself has already lived out those roles. He has. I mean, he is the ultimate builder. He is the King of Kings, and he knows the cost. He's calculated what it takes to save us, and he's recognized the consequences if he does not. And he paid the price. He's gone to war. He's built. And now he's looking for all who will go to war with him for the lives of many, for the sake of the kingdom. And he's looking for disciples who will commit and follow him into battle and stick with the mission all the way to the end, in essence, to be like him and with him and full of him. The sacrifices of cabinet maker named Terry Lane continue to change a drug-riddled neighborhood in Jacksonville, Florida. Terry said, my business has prospered to the point of a 40-man staff needed more space, and so we found an ideal location. In 1985, we built a 25,000-square-foot state-of-the-art plant that was soon humming with activity, but problems erupted. Every night, the burglar alarm was sounded, and I was summoned to the plant by police officers. Broken windows, shots fired, bullets, holes in the walls, stolen equipment, vandalism, even incinerated cars in our parking lot. One officer asked me, what possessed you to build a plant so close to the rock? What do you mean, the rock? Somebody didn't do his homework. And he said, well, the Cleveland Arms apartments. More crack cocaine is sold there than anywhere in Jacksonville, and so we call it The Rock. It's a 200-unit subsidized housing complex, was occupied by drug dealers, prostitutes, and felons, so dangerous that police were hesitant to be around there. But God moved in Terry's spirit. If you love them, I'll take care of it. Forget all that shooting and all the garbage. Just look at the children. Terry prayed for his neighbors. He tried to figure out how to connect with this community right next door to his business. He said, I bought several basketballs, wrote Jesus loves you and Mr. Lane loves you on them, and threw them over the fence into the complex. He said, then one Saturday, I heard the noise of children playing on my property. And when they saw me, one of them said, there's the man! And they started to scatter, as you can imagine. You can just picture it. He said, wait! Would you like something cold to drink? Five little kids stopped, turned around, followed him into the plant where he opened the soft drink machine and gave them each a cold pop. Come Monday afternoon, he heard a commotion in the lobby. He said, I came out and saw 16 kids in the lobby looking for me and more cold drinks. He said, before you knew it, 35 children adopted me, coming to my office every afternoon after school instead of going home. There was nothing for them to go home to. Day after day, while I worked at my drafting table, I was surrounded by kids on the floor, busily coloring or doing other crafts. Thus began the journey that would change my world and that of many of my kids whose addicted parents left them to fend for themselves, often hungry, unkept, undisciplined, with no structure in their lives or motivated to attend church or school. These children would be the next lost generation. And I felt compelled to give them hope. Years flew by, and the kids I mentored became a part of my life. 10 years after I first reached out to those kids of The Rock, Terry sold his share of cabinet making business to his partner, and he started the Metro Inner City Sunday School. And when the kids got older, they started youth groups and teen programs. And it wasn't long before Terry moved into the complex in one of the apartments, and he established a community center called Metro Kids Connection, where the staff feeds over 145 children physically, academically, and spiritually. He said, there's so much to do, but I'm excited and grateful for the direction God chose for me. My wife and I have gone from enjoying a six-figure annual income to subsisting on $12,000 a year. But God faithfully meets every need, and the rewards are incomparable. Nothing can replace the joy of having a little child crawl up into my lap and a hug for Pastor Terry. Or for a young man rescued from a life of dealing drugs, looks me in the eye and shakes my hand with a firm grip and says, thanks, PT. Do the math. It's worth the cost to commit all into his hands. And to commit all the way to the end. And if you've done the math today and you want to make that commitment and give your life to Christ and trust Him for your salvation and to walk with Him in a brand new life beyond anything that you can imagine, it's not going to be easy, but it's going to be more than wonderful. If you want to make that step today to be baptized into Christ, meet me down here in the front. We'll help you take that step. I love this precious time when I remember how much Jesus is committed to us, what He laid down for us. And He followed through on what He intended and what we needed. He went to the cross. And so as we partake of the cup and the loaf today, we're reminded of what He paid. And we need to renew our commitment. And so when you're ready, you can serve yourselves at the four corners in the room if you want to partake of the Lord's Supper.